Les cuento que estoy bien emocionado. Recientemente, The Food Engineer Podcast recibió una subvención de Brewers Association para la diversidad en la industria cervecera artesanal. Esta subvención hace posible que este episodio también llegue a ustedes a través de video. Vayan a YouTube, busquen la página de Food Engineer Podcast y suscríbanse. Allí de una vez le pueden dar like a los videos y pueden darle a la campanita para que cada vez que salga un episodio nuevo se enteren del mismo. La invitada de hoy, Tara Nguyen, es una escritora quien recientemente publicó un libro titulado A Woman's Place is in the Brewhouse, donde ella nos cuenta sobre el rol de la mujer en la industria de la cerveza a través de los siglos. Su historia está muy entrelazada con la mía en varios aspectos, pero eso lo van a escuchar en este episodio. Si están en Puerto Rico y quieren obtener una copia de este libro, pues están de suerte. Tara estará firmando autógrafos de su libro el lunes 25 de enero a las 4 de la tarde en la Taberna Lúpulo en el Viejo San Juan. Vayan y díganle que Cristian los invitó. Bienvenidos a The Food Engineer Podcast, un podcast dedicado a la exploración de alimentos y bebidas fermentadas. Yo soy tu anfitrión, Cristian Mercado. Welcome to a new episode of The Food Engineer Podcast. This is a special episode, one, because we're on video now, so you're going to be able to see this episode. And if you're listening on podcast, make sure that you check us out on YouTube as well. But also because we have a very important guest today. Our guest is Tara Nguyen, an author and a very impressive person that I would like you to get to know through this podcast and to get to hear her story. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here. We have so many things in common to talk about.
Yes. And I would like the audience to know that before this, we had a brief conversation and it seems that whichever topic we pick, we have a lot of stuff in common. So I'm hoping that this is going to be a really nice conversation, quite interactive.
For sure.
So Tara, for those who are listening to this podcast that may not know you or know your work, will you care to give us a brief introduction of who Tara Nguyen is and how she got to writing about beer?
Sure. Well, I'm a freelance journalist. I was, until recently, the beer and spirits contributor to Forbes. Now I write for publications like Food Network, Food and Wine, etc. I published my first book in September 2021. It's the first history of women in beer in book form called The Woman's Places in the Brew House. And thank you for reading it, Christiane. I do a lot of other things as well, mostly in the craft beverage space. I do marketing consulting. I teach 3 university classes. What else do I do? Lots and lots of things. I was a TV reporter for 10 years, and that's what brought me to the Philadelphia area. And then in 2005, I left TV, started freelancing. And my biggest client was the Philadelphia Tourism Bureau. And at that time, there was a lot of activity in the beer space in Philadelphia. Well, there still is. But, you know, there was more going on in Philly beer-wise than most other cities on the East Coast. And I really just started concentrating on writing about that. I loved the ethos. I loved the potential for economic development that I saw breweries could have. And I've really focused primarily on that ever since.
That's such a great story, especially because I met you at a conference where we had a panel on diversity, and I saw you there speaking, and I was quite impressed on how you had the story of women in beer at the palm of your hand always, and you could always pick a new story out of there, and it was always relevant. But then when I went on to see your resume and look at, you know, your work at Forbes and TV, And I was like, wow, this is not someone that came up and wrote a book about beer. This is someone that has been around while the whole history was happening. So like the history in this book, and I'm going to show it here. We'll talk a little bit more in depth about the book later on. But the history that is here is as if you get these new goggles, you put them on, and you start to see the history of beer from a different perspective that was always there, but you didn't know about it. So I really appreciate that you bring a new perspective to this space and to this industry altogether.
Thank you. The way you describe the topic I've written about is really touching. Yeah, I mean, there are so many stories within the history of beer and everything else for that matter that's just been so whitewashed, right? I mean, women have been society's brewers since the very beginning. And here we are in 2022, and women who work in the industry still on the daily get questions like, so you actually like beer? You drink this stuff? And, you know, as I started to say a minute ago, it's not just women. It's people of color. It's non-binary people. Generally, you know, the expression to the victor go the spoils, or there's some twist on that that's like the winner writes the history. And so the stories that we in the United States know about beer tend to be very Eurocentric and very white male dominated. And the stories are there, but they take a lot of digging for in some cases, especially, for instance, I really, when I was writing this book, wanted to know more about enslaved women in the early United States and what they might have been doing, you know, to make beer, whether they were, you know, living on plantations or wherever they were living. And it was just very, very difficult to get to those stories. But they are there. Right. Just takes a lot of tenacity.
That brings an interesting story to my head, which is that of brewers that were enslaved in the past, where the founding fathers, some of them were recognized for their excellent brews, but the actual brewers were their slaves. And I believe that bringing those stories to life should make us understand better what was going on in the panorama of beer and how it could also be perhaps explained in today's society. There are a lot of stories out there, but I believe that there are a lot more protagonists than what we are fed.
That's such a great example. And when you say that, I think immediately of Thomas Jefferson. He gets a lot of credit for brewing great beer. And later in life, he did write recipes and dabble in brewing beer. But really, it was one of his enslaved Africans, Peter Hemmings, who was his brewmaster. And earlier in Jefferson's life, it was his wife, Martha Jefferson, who oversaw the brewing at the plantation, which was common at the time. And even when Martha gets the credit, the person who doesn't get the credit is the enslaved woman who actually was in charge of brewing the beer. Like, Martha would oversee the brewing, maybe, or develop the recipes and then tell people what to do. But it was only recently that I even learned that. So like you're saying, yeah, a lot of protagonists. And it's really gratifying that institutions like Monticello, for instance, you know, mm-hmm. that they've got their own controversies there with race. But those aside, it's gratifying that institutions are really starting to dig deeper into the stories of those people within those histories that have just been hidden for hundreds of years or thousands of years or even just the past few years in some cases.
That's right. Tara, that said, how would you characterize the role of women in beer throughout history? If you were to uber summarize it.
I'm still working on my elevator pitch for the book, which is sad because I've been working on it for like 5 years. But the uber characterization is since it is believed. I mean, when you're talking about ancient history, it's really hard to prove anything. But the conventional wisdom is that ever since we were hunter-gatherers in southern Africa, we have been making and drinking fermented beverages. We believe that alcohol was sort of discovered by accident out in the woods, fermented honey, and pretty quickly, I think, it became somewhat of a staple of the family diet because it had nutrients in it that water might not have. And in different times and places throughout the world, the water might not have been safe to drink. There might have been contaminants in it. So because beer has been a family beverage for so long, it became kitchen work. So as my one of my mentors likes to say, while the men were out hunting mastodon, the women were back tending the fire, the children, and making the beer. And it basically continued like that throughout human history. I mean, it's really crazy how different places at different times, the same story is there, where this is women's work. Some women were able to make surplus, sell it for a little bit of money, maybe a little bit of independence. And then at a certain time in every single civilization, either politics, religion, or economics stepped in and replaced the women with men. And then here we are, again, like I said, in 2022, and women who are now occupying beer industry spaces more than they have in decades are still dealing with a lot of just dumb misogyny and discrimination.
And that leads me to a note that I made while reading your book about Rhonda Kalman when she was working at Boston Beer Company, and how you write about how she was often mistaken for someone that was doing other job other than pretty much running Boston Beer Company.
Yeah. You know, if you go out to the West Coast, you still hear some of these old guys talk about it. I mean, they don't say it like this, but basically they accused Jim Cook and Rhonda Kalman, who was his first employee. She was doing, I think, pretty much all the sales or most of the sales at the beginning. And they went to the Great American Beer Festival and won the People's Choice Award. And they got accused of stuffing the ballot boxes. And Rhonda had to dismiss accusations that she was trading sexual favors for votes.
Wow.
And that would have been
preposterous.
Probably in the late 80s, wow. Early 90s, maybe. Yeah.
So I mean, not as distant.
It's not as distant. And the thing is, one of the things that just was so eye-opening to me is that some of the discrimination that I wrote about from thousands of years ago still happens almost the exact same way today. People ask me sometimes what was the most surprising thing I turned up in my research, and that's it. That we are still fighting the same exact battles.
And that's certainly unfortunate, given that we like to think that we live in a world that equality is closer than ever. But there are tough conversations that have to be had. And this not only applies to this industry, but an industry that we greatly care about is beer. And I believe this is the time to talk about it. This is the time to air all these concerns. And people like you are putting these stories out there so that people like me can learn about story and history, and then perhaps apply the knowledge gained through your book to the current times. Why did you do X, Y, or Z? Well, because I read about a story similar to that, and I don't want to be the bad guy in the book. I want to move this industry forward by giving people an opportunity to fulfill their potential. And I think that should be the spirit that we should be following for anything that has to do with diversity nowadays.
Well, it's awesome. You know, you mentioned that we met at the MBAA summit, but we met because you co-chair the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee for that. And it's amazing that organizations are starting to bring speakers in like me to talk about these things. And it's also very gratifying to look at my colleagues in journalism and not just journalists, but, you know, other brewery owners and people in the industry who are really trying to bring inclusion to the forefront. But there are some other beer journalists who are doing amazing work on really highlighting the stories, good and bad, of what it's like to be a person of color or, you know, anybody from the non-dominant population in the beer world. And hopefully, yes, we are all working together to move things forward.
Certainly. Now, Tara, when writing these stories, how do you go about it? What does it take to find these stories and to be able to make them coalesce into something that ties all of the information together and you can place it in such a nice manner in the way you write? Because I think, to me, one of the most important things about your book, other than the stories themselves, is the artful way in which you tell these stories. Mm-hmm. What does it take to do so?
Thank you. I've been a journalist and a writer a long time. So I think maybe first and foremost, it takes a lot of practice. Let's see. I've been a working journalist since 1994. So, you know, like I said, a lot of practice, but also I would tell anybody thinking about writing a book that they really do have to love their subject. And this is my favorite thing to talk about. I mean, I love talking about beer. And then once you add women to the equation, it really is my favorite subject. If I can get somebody's ear and they appear to be at least half interested, then, you know, it's hard to stop me from talking. And another thing that made writing this book very easy is the fact that, well, a lot of things, but one of those things is that the people I got to write about are just some of the most accomplished, intelligent, ambitious, tenacious people I've ever heard of in my life. I mean, to have been a woman in the industry at the beginning of craft beer, for instance, in the late 70s, early 80s, they faced so much adversity and they just kept going. And you and I were talking before we started recording. I happened to write about an old professor of yours, Melly Pullman. And, you know, we were like chuckling because her resume must be like 85 pages long. And all I could really say about her to talk about like what she's done since she opened a brewery back in the 80s was say something like highly accomplished academic Melly Pullman. And that was it. So the stories really, I just had so much incredible material. I guess that's what it comes down to. Like, it was inspiring and humbling to write about all of these people. And I had so much more material than I could ever possibly use. I mean, that was the hard part. Like, I had 90,000 words I was allowed to use, and I could have gone on and on and on and on and on with so much great detail. And the quotes I was getting from these people, I had to cut. Like we say in journalism, sometimes you have to kill your babies. Like, you might have a part of your something you wrote or a quote, and you just can't use it. And you're like, no, I can't kill my baby. So.
Wow. And even then, like, I did notice that you were purposely succinct at telling some of the stories, but in, like, as you can see here from this picture, like, I'm almost halfway through the book. And in each chapter, I found myself doing several things. One of them was I have, like, a little collection of beer books. And I would be reading something. I look to the site and, you know, like, in the book spine, you get the author name. So a lot of the people that are mentioned here are authors of books that I've read or cool. are people that I've read about in other books. So I found myself just going through other books to kind of cross-reference everything. And like, for example, you talked about Jennifer Talley. She wrote mm-hmm. a book about session beers, but mm-hmm. I didn't know what got her to that industry and how she learned on I believe she learned under Melly or someone else in that industry.
They knew each other.
Yeah. Right. And mm-hmm. and that there's a link between all these people. There are stories, but these are real people that, unlike other books, they're not dead. They're here with us. They're doing a great job nowadays. And while you read this, you're able to go there and read about their own books, their own stories. Go drink the beers they make nowadays. So that makes it like tangible knowledge, if I may call it that.
You know, that's something I hadn't directly thought of, that, you know, we've got all these beer people we put up on pedestals, and I'd say, like, not, maybe a little bit, maybe it's a tiny bit more balanced now, but I'd say probably, like, 98% of them are dudes, right? And maybe people can name, like, 3 to 5 female beer celebrities, but if you read this book, like, there are hundreds out there. So go find them at conferences and such. Go patronize their breweries and, like, hear their stories, like you're saying.
Mm-hmm. That also brings me to people like Dr. J Jackson, who has been leading this cause of diversity in beer, to the point where I got to meet her was also at a conference where she gave the keynote speech. And you talk about her and her relationship to the DEI efforts, how it links to also Pink Boots and other associations and societies here. So I feel like this is a network, and it is our responsibility as people in the industry of providing knowledge and perhaps digesting knowledge, to put it out there and to have people know that it exists and that they can go and drink history.
Oh, drink history. And, you know, I want to plug the website Good Beer Hunting. Yes. They do the best job, I think, of telling the DEI stories. So for your viewers and listeners who want to get more into that topic, that would be a really good place to start.
Nice. Now, Tara, in one of our first interactions through social media, I discovered that we have some things in common, and that is a place.
Yes, and I really want to do this. Don't laugh at me.
No, it's all fine.
Yes, let's talk about it.
So, as everybody that listens to this podcast knows already, I grew up in Puerto Rico, and most of the episodes of the podcast are in Spanish, with the exception of a few, because we want to bring more stories for people to learn. And throughout all these searches, I wrote a message on a post from the guys of Breaking News Beer and Coffee. And that's where it turns out that you spoke Spanish, and I didn't know that you had a relationship to Puerto Rico, of all places. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I do a little bit more. No, I can't tell you a little bit more. I have to tell you a lot more. First of all, if my mother had her way, we would be doing this interview in Spanish, because she raised me to speak Spanish. Like, she, I'll tell you why in a second, but she retired from a career as a Spanish teacher. And growing up, she only spoke Spanish to my brother and me. Unless she was mad at us, and then she would speak English, and we always knew that we needed to run and hide if she was speaking English. So as quickly as I can, but unfortunately, because I really don't speak Spanish, I don't take the opportunity to speak Spanish, I was like, I can't do a whole interview in Spanish anymore, I'm sorry. But one day. So anyway, as quickly as possible, the story of Puerto Rico and me is that it is my second home. Back in around 1950, my mother, when she was a child, and her parents and her brother and sister, every winter they would go to Florida from Long Island, where they lived, at every Christmas time. And one year, they were sitting on the beach, and it was so cold, they had to wear gloves. And they were like, this isn't fun.
Wow.
So my grandfather was a dentist and a Rotarian, and I think one of his patients had told him about Puerto Rico, because back then, you know, most Americans hadn't really heard of it, much less traveled there. So they were like, all right, let's go check this Puerto Rico place out. And lo and behold, they, and then my mother, continuing the tradition, went to Puerto Rico every Christmas time for about 70 years.
Wow.
So that's what made my mom decide to become a Spanish teacher. That's what made her decide to become bilingual. And for most, the vast majority of those years, we went to Vega Baja. So every year until I was in my mid-20s and had to, like, actually work and couldn't take 2 to 3 weeks off the holiday season to go with my family, I also went to Puerto Rico as a kid. And we wouldn't go to, you know, the touristy places. Sure, we'd, like, go sneak into Cerro Mad and, like, have lunch and play in the pool or whatever. But, you know, generally we were staying at friends' houses, empty houses, at the beach in Vega Baja and Puerto Nuevo, and I'm laughing saying empty because most people listening will be like, what do you mean you went to the beach at Christmas time? Of course their beach houses were empty. It's freezing. Right. So we stayed in their empty beach houses. And we're family. Like, we're family without being blood. We go for funerals, weddings, and God, we must be on like 6 generations at this point. And wow. I'm sorry, I just have to like say one more thing.
No, go ahead.
It's so important to me, and I know you'll have to edit. Oh, 2 things. You can edit whatever you would like, but I have to say 2 more things. One, so after the last time I went in my 20s, it was a long time before I went back, and that was probably like 17 years ago at this point. I went back once, and then I didn't go again for another 14 years or so. And just by several coincidences, I ended up going 3 or even 4 times in 2019.
Wow.
Once, yeah, a couple media trips. Discover Puerto Rico brought me a few times. And I discovered the world of craft beer in Puerto Rico. And obviously, between the time I was in my 20s, which I'm going to admit was in the 90s and 2000s, and then, you know, I become a beer writer. It's my life. I love it. And then I go back to this old childhood place where I didn't expect to find craft beer, you know, and then I stumble on all of these offerings, both the Puerto Rican craft breweries and the amazing American and European breweries whose beer is sold there. And I made all these new friends. And it was like, I don't know. Like, it used to make me cry thinking about it because I had like all of my childhood people and then this whole new grown-up beer life there. And I'm going back for 2 weeks at the end of January and probably doing a book event at Taberna Lupulo. So,
you guys heard it here first.
Social media and stuff. Sorry?
You guys heard it here first. She's going to be in Puerto
Rico. Actually, that may be true. You heard it here first. It's not confirmed, but follow my social and we will promote it. I actually thank Zalika at the end of my book. But the other thing that I do want to say, and I really love this story, although it's not entirely appropriate. I developed a taste for alcohol as a young child because of Puerto Rico. Because like I said, we would go at Christmas time, so there were always a lot of parties. And I discovered that rum is sweet and delicious. So yes. We would go to the same Christmas Eve party every year, and these people had a bar in their house. And I realized that if I made my parents their Cuba Libres, they were happy because they didn't have to get up and make it themselves. And I could sneak sips because I wasn't allowed to drink soda, much less rum, when I was like 6. So I'd be like, ooh, rum and Coke, this is really good. So I'd be like mixing, sip. And then after like 2 years of this, I realized that I could make my own rum and Cokes and like hide them behind the bar. So I am telling you, I was like 7 or 8 drinking full glasses of Cuba Libre every Christmas Eve. I never got busted. When my brother turned about 5, he started barbacking for me. And here we are today.
That was a family enterprise.
It was. It was great. It's my, it's like my guilty, not even guilty, but like I love a good Cuba Libre to this day. I like get so sentimental and happy when I drink them.
So, Tara, I'm just amazed about how many things we have in common, and to know that you have such a tight-knit history with Puerto Rico and now rum too, which is a topic that I love to talk about. And actually, there's a whole topic on it. There's an episode on rum. And I want to preface by saying that there will be a lot more episodes about rum soon and flavored rums, but that's going to be material for the future. But as you talk about it, how this shaped your perception of alcohol and how you came back 19 years later, now with a different mindset, with a different set of experiences, but also with the ability to perhaps enjoy this local drinks, this local beer, this new craft beer scene that is, what, maybe 10 years old? It's a little bit more, but in its current shape, it's about 10 years old. When you talk about this, when you write about these stories in your professional life, how do you go about it? And what would you tell someone that would like to follow your steps and become a journalist or a writer in the scene of food and beer?
There are obviously a lot of different ways to go about it. I'm not sure mine is the easiest. As I said, I was a TV reporter for 10 years, very competitive. I was very fortunate to be able to do it, and then I decided that was enough, and we already talked about how I got to where I am. But, you know, actually, I would say, well, you know, I think you're setting a great example. You know, even though I would certainly caution any aspiring journalists that it's certainly not at all a lucrative profession, it's hard to make a living on it sometimes, which is why I enjoy supplementing with corporate writing as well. And I think that's a great way to, you know, write about what you love and then take my knowledge, because I do corporate writing in the beer space. So it's kind of win-win. Anyway, tangent. So I think what you are doing by going out there, finding the stories other people are not telling, and then finding places, whether it's your own sort of blog situation or, you know, you're pitching stories to beer publications and websites that have interest in them, anybody can do that. I mean, as long as you can, like, figure out how to tell the story and be accurate and fair, and I mean doing that, like, you know, people get degrees and all of that, so we'll leave that for another time. But anybody can do it. Before I went down for the first time to Puerto Rico in 2019, and I knew I wanted to sort of tell some beer stories, meet some beer people, I did internet research. And the first person I think I encountered was William, and I'm blanking on his last name right now, but he ran a homebrew shop and then was planning to open a brewery from there. I'm not sure if he did.
William Norris?
Yes. Yes, thank you. And he was fabulous. He put me in touch with a lot of other people. I think he even, I'm drinking out of my Pura, can you see it? My Pura yes. Vida glass right now. I think he put me in touch with those women, a lot of other women. And, you know, in the beer space, we all love to talk. Most of us are very social. We know a lot of people. So as far as finding stories, and I'm tangenting again, I think, because you asked me how to become a writer, but, you know, if I had no experience, but I wanted to write a story about beer in Puerto Rico, what I would probably do if I didn't know anybody, I would find a good beer bar. And I'm going to use Taverna Lupilo, for instance, because Zalika knows everybody and knows everything. I'd go there. I would introduce myself. I'd have some beers, tell them what I was looking to do. And especially in Puerto Rico, where, you know, everyone knows everybody, I would probably have like 55 friends, new strangers
yeah.
who would become new friends show up at that bar within like an hour. So networking is key. Do you want me to talk more about the writing path? I know I didn't really
No, I mean, I
say a lot about that.
I think it's great that you use your own story, but also kind of salt and pepper it with, you know, there are professionals here, but also here's this other path, right? And that's okay with me.
Okay. Because I also went to grad school for broadcast journalism. You know, one could certainly go to school and learn the trade, and, you know, the university, whatever university you go to, has tons and tons and tons of networking and job opportunities and such. So, you know, that's another option for people who have the ability to go to school at this point in their lives. I wouldn't steer anybody away from that, although it's not necessary.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point of view, I think, because we live in an era where information is so available, and there's so many things that you can do if you have the will to go and find out the information. So I like that you bring all of those perspective, and like a good reporter, you're fair about both points.
Thank you. Which, you know, actually, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, which takes me to your book again. We've been talking about your book almost the entire time, just because I was pleasantly surprised about the storytelling aspect of it. But while writing this book, what stories caught your attention the most? Like, what was that story that moved you to your core?
A lot of them. The one I tend to tell the most, the one that stands out to me the most, is the very first story in the book about Suzanne Dennison, who co-founded New Albion with Jack McAuliffe as the first ground-up independent brewery since before Prohibition in the United States. She was just like this enigmatic figure to me. It took me years, actually, to convince her to talk to me. And so I just had this, like, mystery about her. And I knew that she had put up half the money for New Albion. And she had worked there from day one till the very last day. And she disappeared. Like, before I put her in the book, I only know of one journalist and one museum curator who had ever interviewed her in modern times. And I got to find her. We ultimately became friends. The fact that, you know, this was, her brewery was the very beginning of craft brewing, and no one knows she exists. And yet she's this 80-some-year-old woman who was a yoga instructor for decades after she closed the brewery. And before that, she, you know, was an interpreter for the UN, very intelligent. Wow. And, you know, her co-owner, Jack, has gotten all this credit over the past, I don't know, what is it, 18 years now or so? I mean, he disappeared for a couple decades too, but he came back and got, you know, he got to brew with all, you know, so many beer celebrities, and his name is on a lot of beers. And through all of that, there was Susie, who was like this ghost in the background no one knew about.
So it's interesting, because that's also the story that I read, obviously, first, because it's on the first chapter, but that I heard about it in school. And out of all places, I was taking a course at the hotel school at Cornell University, and it was mentioned to us that New Albion was the first craft brewing endeavor in the modern era, if you may call it that. But it was only told to us perhaps in the perspective of Jack and New Albion, and perhaps the partner that was there. But you brought that story to light, and I want to thank you for that, because I learned.
Thank you. Well, you know, one of the biggest impacts the book has had on me is that people like Susie and people like Melly, who are not known in the beer world really at all. I mean, Melly was a little bit more, but are finally getting some recognition. Like, Susie is now very closely in touch with the Seattle chapter of the Pink Boots Society. I think she came and was a special guest during, like, Big Brew Day, and she's finally getting some attention. And I do want to give credit. There was a third founder of New Albion. She didn't stick around longer than about a year or so, but another woman, Jane Zimmerman, who put up the other half of the money. So Susie put up half, Jane put up half, Jack didn't put up a cent.
Wow. Wow. that's eye-opening, right? Because I feel that the burden of responsibility sometimes is lost when stories are told. Stories are sometimes told from the point of view of the excitement and a great story nonetheless, but who carried the economical part, the financial, the responsibilities, and sometimes even the part of being mothers through this process? And I believe that that is something that has to be said. Again, thank you for saying that as well.
There's a term that I learned while researching this book, and I really love it. It's archival silences. And that's what we're talking about. It's those spaces that were in reality filled by women, people of color, etc., but whose stories weren't necessarily written down, and so we don't know them. And those are the silences in our archival history.
Well, Tara, I want to thank you for your time, for being accessible to doing this interview, but not before telling people about your book, A Woman's Place is in the Brew House by Tara Nurain. Where can they find it, and where can they find you?
So, you can buy the book on anywhere online you normally buy books. You can also find it in bookstores. If you go to a bookstore and they don't carry it, ask for it. You can also get an autographed copy, a personally signed copy by me. If you email me, go to my website, you can get my contact information there. I'm all over social media, and because I am hoping to do a book event in late January at Taverna Lupulo, definitely follow me on social, because I'll post the details once I have them. And it's basically my name on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, which is Tara Nurain, T-A-R-A-N-U-R-I-N. And yeah, come have a beer with me while I'm down there. I would love to meet anybody watching this.
Go ahead. Follow Tara in her social spaces, in her platforms. I highly suggest you get the book, whether you get a physical copy or a digital copy. It's a great book, especially I like to read a little bit before going to bed. And it's like eye-opening, and at the same time, it's got so much good storytelling that it's calming. So go ahead, take a look at it. Also, while in the process, make sure that you go ahead and follow us if you don't do that already. Subscribe to this podcast, the Food Engineer Podcast, everywhere. It's the same handle. Look us up on YouTube. And if you have a chance, in the platform where you're listening to this, leave us a review so that other people have the opportunity to find this podcast and hear great stories like Tara's. So thank you all, and see you in the next episode of the Food Engineer Podcast. Goodbye.
Adios y gracias.
Este episodio fue producido y editado por este servidor, Cristian Mercado. La versión en video de este episodio puede ser conseguida en YouTube y fue editada gracias a una colaboración con Color Keys. Todo este episodio llega a ustedes en múltiples formatos gracias a una subvención de Brewers Association. visita brewersassociation.org para que te enteres de cómo esta asociación profesional representa a las cervecerías artesanales y provee herramientas e información para aquellos que están en esta industria. No quiero irme sin antes darle las gracias al señor Pedro Lavezari y a su sello Orange Fox Music por proveer la música de The Food Engineer Podcast. La canción que escuchan en el fondo se titula El Abrazo Más Puro. Pueden conseguirla en Bandcamp o pueden ir a las notas de este episodio para que consigan más información sobre Pedro Lavezari y su música. Si The Food Engineer Podcast te provee valor en tu vida profesional, te invito a que vayas a mi página de Patreon y apoyes este podcast con una donación mensual empezando en $3. Hasta pronto.